Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Once again, the sleep doctor is in our studio, as we like to call Dr. Eric Dykin, neurologist and director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. We are catching up on our sleep news and research with Dr. Dykin. How are you doing, Dr. Dykin? Thanks for coming over to the studio.
Pretty good. How are you doing?
I'm good. White coat and all.
Oh, it's cold outside.
Starting to get that way. We want to reach out to you, as we like to do the entire hour when we have Dr. Dykin, and ask you, how is your sleep? Share your sleep problem or perhaps an unusual sleep experience this hour. Get some advice from Dr. Dykin. Perhaps you've changed something in your life that has led to better sleep that we can all learn from, and Dr. Dykin can comment on. Join our sleep discussion this hour, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. If you'd rather write an email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Dr. Dykin, a little later in the hour, we want to talk about this baffling case of the 7-year-old Kentucky boy in the news in early October, awoke from an 11-day sleep. He slept for 11 days straight. The details on that coming up in just a moment. And it's, by the way, not something you want to do.
Right.
And Dr. Dykin will explain that a little bit later, even though you can be really tired at the end of a work week and think, I could have slept for 11 days. No. Let's talk about the Nobel Prize for medicine this year. Three American scientists awarded the prize in medicine for their discoveries of molecular mechanisms controlling the circadian rhythm. These Nobel laureates sharing this year's prize in medicine, Jeffrey Hall, Michael Rosbach, and Michael Young. Dr. Dykin, we've known for many years, of course, that living organisms, including us humans, have this internal biological clock. Plants even have it. So what did these Nobel laureates then discover that earned them this prize?
Well, they discovered and measured the product of specific genes. And the one that becomes the biggest name in the public's eye is the period gene, which has another gene that helps control its production of a protein. So genes can produce proteins. And during the dark of night, this period gene, in association with another gene that's called the timeless or the double time gene, produces a protein that builds up and up, and its own protein production inhibits further release at a certain point. So when you go to sleep, this protein builds up, starts to lower itself, and toward morning, it gets to a point where you wake up and it degrades during the day. So that buildup of protein that self-controls itself at a certain point with the assistance of another specific gene is auto-controlling a waking-sleeping cycle to some extent that is modified by the effects of the sun during the day and darkness during the night, and they call it the transcription feedback loop process.
Wow. Wow. So it's kind of like when you talk about those proteins, if I'm understanding this right, and it's very simplified, that you've got kind of a reservoir of protein. And when you get to a certain level, that's when you feel wake, when you wake up, and when you feel like you can go through the day, and then those proteins degrade during the day.
Well, actually, they build up during the night, and then they decrease themselves, and they're degraded during the day.
Okay.
Now, you and I had talked about another parallel that we can relate to coffee. Now, during the day, when you're active, adenosine, ATP, people have heard of that. It's broken down so you can move and do your daily activities. Adenosine is a byproduct of that. That adenosine builds up during the day, and it attaches to sleepiness receptors in your brain, and you get sleepy by the end of the day. In this one, and you can counteract that with caffeine because it blocks those receptors. But this one, during the night when you're asleep, the protein builds up and it gets to a certain level where it levels out. And during the day, it decreases.
Interesting. So The discovery of these Nobel laureates, the work that they've done, does that have an impact, a practical impact on what you do at the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics when you find someone with a sleep problem? Does that translate into solving everyday sleep problems?
In a sense, it doesn't. It explains certain things. There are an awful lot of famous people. David Bowie, a rock and roll musician, who said, "It's a shame I have to sleep." But you sleep for a reason, because these products build up during the day when we talk about ATP, and some products build up during the night. And we know they're doing that to help us sustain a normal sleep-wake schedule, because simplistically, during sleep, there's a lot of restoration. There's a lot of repair, if you will. And if you don't get the good 7 to 9 hours of sleep, as most American adults need, you don't restore well. And we know that less sleep equates to more illness and shorter longevity.
We'll talk about some problems in specific studies, recent studies, in just a few minutes. Let me ask, before we go to our callers, Dr. Daikin of the University of Iowa Sleep Disorders Center with us, if you'd like to join our conversation with your sleep question or your sleep problem, 1-866-780-9100. Of course, those of us who've dealt with jet lag, or those on those shift workers, rotating shifts, know what it's like to work not in sync with your biological clock, your circadian rhythms. You have this zombie-like existence. Mm. So that's explained through their work as well. The feeling that you have being out of sync with the planet's rotation, so to speak.
Oh, absolutely. That's the jet lag. And, you know, a simple way we look at it, and in a young adult who's flying to London, about 7 hours difference, about a week, for every 1 hour change in your bedtime and awakening time, it takes you approximately 1 day to adapt. The first 3 days are the worst with jet lag. But it takes you about 7 days, and you look at the Olympic athletes who fly to Barcelona, you know, depending on where their home origin is, it takes you about a week to really adapt physiologically to that new time zone, and especially the exposure to light, the sun as it comes up in that time zone, and as it goes down, the dark, the night of that time zone, the Zeitgeber, that helps regulate the circadian rhythm that has a genetic basis.
So it's the quality of the dawn and the dusk light, not just any light, but those specific times that cues your brain.
Yeah. And in fact, you can try to fool the system, and we may talk about that later with some therapies, if you're not privy to those. And we do know that when you have less light exposure in the winter months, where we live, you have a higher risk of affective disorder, seasonal affective disorder, major depression. It can throw the body, especially if it's in that bell-shaped curve of sensitivities, into a major depression in some people. So we have to adjust, adapt to our environment.
Catching up on our sleep news and research with Dr. Eric Daikin of the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to our first caller. In Des Moines, Patty is with us. Hi, Patty. How are you today? You getting good sleep?
I am. I am medicated for narcolepsy, but my husband was sleeping up to 12 hours a day, and when he went in for a sleep study, he came back with one of those machines, and he's still sleeping up to 12 hours a day, and I didn't know if he had any ideas.
Mm. Yeah, and you know what is implicit with sleep apnea, there is a specific disorder called persistent sleepiness despite successful treatment of, and it's usually obstructive sleep apnea. And there's a theory. Now, sleep apnea is a disorder where you have a floppy throat. I have sleep apnea. And when you go to sleep at night, the muscles around the opening of your throat relax and they close off like a wet straw, and you get low oxygen to your brain and all these centers that we've already talked about, these sleep centers in the brain, where these genes are controlling the circadian rhythm of all of our cells. It might do some damage to that, microscopic. You might not see it on an imaging study, an MRI or a head CAT scan. So in this type of persistent sleepiness, on occasion what we do is we bring the patient into the sleep laboratory. We put them on their treatment, continuous positive airway pressure therapy, a small mask that goes over the nose or the mouth, delivers a gentle column of air, keep the airway open. Make sure the apnea is well treated, let you sleep as long as you can, 7 to 9 hours. Then we wake you up in the morning and we give you those naps that you had to take to get that diagnosis of narcolepsy. 5 daytime naps separated by 2 hour intervals about, and we see how sleepy you are. And if you're still sleepy on that nap, you are given that series of naps, the diagnosis of persistent sleepiness despite well-treated apnea, with the thought there may have been microscopic damage to those sleep-wake centers. And as such, the treatment of choice now is modafinil. And people often do okay on that medicine, but sometimes you have to use alternative therapies.
Mm-hmm. Patty, how does that sound? Does your husband, with the CPAP machine, did you notice that he's enjoying his waking hours more than before, even though he sleeps still 12 hours a day?
No, just like the doctor said, he whines about being sleepy all day.
Okay.
Yeah, talk to your healthcare professional, have a sit down, get that full history, look under the hood, do the physical exam, and then they might want to consider repeating those studies on the CPAP with the follow-up nap studies.
Thanks for calling in, Patty, we wish you and your husband the best of sleep in Des Moines. All right. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Neurologist Dr. Eric Dykin of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Before we go to our next caller, let me ask you about this unusual case in Kentucky. Of course, we just talked about the three U.S. scientists winning this year's Nobel Prize in Medicine for their work on the internal biological clock. But imagine sleeping for 11 days straight. Well, this happened to a 7-year-old boy named Wyatt Shaw. Slept 11 days straight inside a Kentucky hospital, recently woke up. It was the Norton Children's Hospital. Doctors, at the point of the article that I referred to, didn't know what caused him to fall into this slumber. You've read this case, Dr. Dykin. What can you say about what happened? It is a mystery to the doctors treating him, right?
Well,
somewhat.
You know, you get the relatively limited story, and it is entertainment when you read a newspaper, and it is fascinating when good things happen. But they did mention that this young kid was at a big family wedding outing. He developed a stomach ache and a headache, and then he went into this period of sleepiness that was approximately 2 weeks. And we had a similar publication, but they implied that this was not just normal sleep. And in fact, they did have periods where they attempted to wake him up and he would get up. It was implicit by the limited nature of the publication that he was up, then he went right back to sleep. But when you get a viral encephalopathy, and this is what our patient had for 2 weeks. So you treat the common cold, usually a virus. You're never going to pull that out, grow it out in a culture. It's hard to find out what that virus is because they're everywhere. But a common cold, if you treat it with antibiotics, it lasts 2 weeks. If you leave it alone, it lasts 14 days. Same thing. I mean, you know, it's the same thing. This child got the headache, he got this disorder, and he went out. Now, our patient, who was a young adult, we called it stupor coma. Now, I'm not sure exactly what the EEG looked like on this child, but our young adult had a normal sleep-wake schedule. We never grew the virus out on culture because it's very difficult to do. We even looked at a spinal fluid analysis. But after 2 weeks, he woke up, and he was perfectly normal at that time, but during it, he was in stupor coma with normal sleep-wake schedule. So even in that case, and usually we don't grow out the virus, this child still is not normal, what they're saying. He's having trouble with walking and talking, and I would think that this is a viral encephalopathy. Mm-hmm. So stupor coma can be associated with normal sleep-wake scheduling and brainwaves, and that's a good prognostic sign. But an imaging study, as is implied, does not take the place of a good physical examination or historical. And you don't grow out everything. And you know what? Doctors and nurses, we don't know everything, and there are acts of God. But I would think that this is more compatible with something like that because you can't see it. But who knows? you and I aren't really privy to those private medical records.
Right. And in the article that we saw this account in, the, mentioned the world record for the longest period someone has gone without sleep, a person named Randy Gardner, 264 hours. That was 11 days, 25 minutes, but also some real problems. Not the type of sleep you want to get. Serious cognitive changes reported by the physicians caring for him, hallucinations, paranoia, short-term memory problems.
Yeah, fighting Mother Nature, dangerous thing, but great thing. Looks like this child is doing a lot better.
Dr. Eric Dykin with us. We're going to take a break in a few minutes, but before that, let's go to our phones. They dial to join us with our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to Iowa City. Sam is with us in Iowa City. Hi, Sam.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure thing.
I get about 8 hours of sleep a night, and I've been using pink noise to encourage more dreaming so I can get more lucid dreaming going on.
There you go.
Is there any research that actually helps encourage dreaming, or should I be doing something else?
Well, isn't that interesting? You know, because pink noise, we talked about my friend
right.
Phyllis Z over at Northwestern.
In a previous show, we had examples of white noise, pink noise. There was a third noise. I can't remember what
brown,
it was.
And it
brown
sounds
noise.
Like fire and smoke. You can almost
I couldn't
see it.
Tell the difference, but of course,
yeah.
your learned ears could, Doctor.
Yeah.
So tell us about pink noise.
Well, you know, and again, I think this is what Phyllis Z over at Northwestern was doing the studies on. And when you have this kind of pink noise, there are different decibels, there are different wavelengths, there are different hertz. You know, it's a bit beyond me. But what she showed is when you could sleep with that as background white noise, if you will, which is a completely different thing, people got more slow wave sleep, which is really a 2-cycle-per-second discharge from the brain that some experts correlate with the deeper, more relaxing stage of sleep. But REM sleep, as you've implied, people and at Stanford sleep laboratories, even one of our students, Tahar Bahati, many years ago, he went and got trained in lucid dreaming. And they tell me you can train people to control their dreams, where they can fly and they can control them, and they have the greatest experiences with controlling dreams. There are some drugs that can reduce REM sleep, and we use that to treat narcolepsy, like the young lady who called in just before. And there are some drugs that can increase REM sleep. And there's one out on the market right now, and it's sort of a paradox to me. It would induce more REM sleep, potentially more dream sleep, but it also induces pathologic sleepiness, which you got to be careful when you're starting to deal with drugs. And between you and me, I would go holistic. I would keep good cognitive behavioral therapies and sleep hygiene factors, but all drugs have side effects. Too much water can kill you if you get your sodium and potassium too low.
Okay.
So my thought would, they're probably out there, but I would do basic good sleep hygiene and have good thoughts, and they'll make better dreams in general.
Hey, Sam, if you're still there, before I let you go, can you share something appropriate for public radio, a zany dream, a glimpse into one of your zany dreams that you remember?
Oh, a zany one I had recently. I do jiu-jitsu at the university.
Yep.
And every once in a while I have a dream where I do jiu-jitsu in my dream. That's about as vivid as I can get.
That's pretty good.
I know how to improve that dream. You should go to the University Taekwondo Club with Master Ashton and learn Taekwondo with the team. That's my alma mater, so I thought I'd throw that in. Good luck to you.
Thank you, Sam, in Iowa City. Let's go to Jim in Prescott. Jim is calling up to talk to Eric Dykin, neurologist, director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Jim, I hope you're there from Prescott. Jim, are you there?
Hello?
Yes, sir. Jim, you're on the air. Welcome to the program.
Oh, hi. This is Jim Crawford from Prescott, Iowa, and I go to sleep no matter what time of night I go to bed, 2 in the morning or 9 at night. I'll sleep an average of 4 hours and wake up, and I'm awake for at least an hour. And I can't tell. I'm sitting watching TV, and I will go to sleep and not even know it. And wake back up and not know that I have wakened. Mm-hmm. Is there anything a person can do about that?
Well, you know, we call that sleep inertia. In fact, I just gave a talk to a support group out in Cedar Rapids. And, you know, everybody is empathetic to what you know, working on fumes when you're really sleep deprived. You can do things and not even remember them, and family members will remind you of that. When I'm on call, I'll often be called many, many times throughout the night, come back in during the day, and the sleep tech said, hey, it worked. I said, well, what worked? They said, that recommendation you made, and I don't remember doing it. I was working on fumes. Now, you imply there's another problem. You go to sleep, and something wakes you up, and you're up for an hour. But I got to tell you, do you snore?
No, not if I do, it's very light, and it's very seldom.
Well, you know,
my wife tells me I don't.
Oh, and you always wonder what could cause you to wake up. But when I hear a resonant voice, and you have a resonant voice, I wonder about redundant oropharyngeal tissue. I wonder about over-relaxation at night and potential sleep apnea. Now, there are a lot of things. Literally 5,432,000 different things that cause you to wake up at night. But if your problem is not able to sleep throughout the night, and these arousals where you go in and out of wakefulness, you need to see your healthcare professional, have a sit down, and go over all the different things that could be causing that and get it treated, because that sleep inertia, if you're doing it while driving a car, correct me if I'm wrong, that could be dangerous. What do you think?
I have gone to sleep at a red light.
Go see them tomorrow and have your wife drive you there. Because my kids are out there on the road, and you want to protect yourself and you want to protect others. But, yeah, have a sit down, because there are literally a million things that could be causing your arousal. I always worry about apnea, but that's just one of a million. See your healthcare professional. Get that taken care of, okay?
What kind of a doctor should I look for?
Go to your primary care physician. That is the backbone of medicine, the best place for us all to start. And that's where I would go to do if I were you.
Jim, we wish you much better sleep in the future. Jim from Prescott, thank you. 1-866-780-9100. We're going to come back in just a minute with Dr. Eric Dyke, a neurologist, director of the Sleep Disorders Program at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. How's your sleep? Share your sleep problem or unusual sleep experience this hour. Perhaps you have something that you can share with the rest of us that you changed in your life that led to better sleep. That's also something you can chip in, not only the sleep problems, but the sleep remedies. Dr. Dyken is here. We're going to talk about some more research when we come back, postpartum depression, also anger's connection, anger as a trait, that connection to sleep when we return. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Ben Kiefer back with Dr. Eric Dyken in just a moment.
To say good night, good night. Sleep tight. Now the sun turns out his light. Good night. Sleep tight. Dream, sweet dream.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're catching up on our sleep news and research with Dr. Eric Dyken of the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. He's a neurologist and director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. We're entertaining your questions. How is your sleep? Perhaps you have an unusual sleep experience or some bad sleeping that you'd like to get some advice about. 1-866-780-9100. Got a number of calls and emails, Dr. Dyken, to get to, so we're going to try to get to as many as possible. Also covering the latest research, here is a research I'd like to have you comment on that looked into the trait of anger and sleep. So it's a study that investigated whether the trait of anger is linked to actual sleep behavior and what anger tendencies play the most important role for particular aspects of sleep. What did you think when you saw this study?
Well, sort of interesting, you know, and they define the different elements that anger can be associated with. And they broke it down very simply that anger control, if you have poor anger control, regardless of gender, age, race, socioeconomic status, stress, then you don't necessarily sleep less, but the quality of your sleep, the indices of sleep integrity, which means continuity and efficiency of sleep. So you'll get 8 hours of sleep, but they tend not to have good continuity, little micro arousals. And again, they might sleep 10 hours, get 8 hours of sleep, but very inefficient, very non-continuous sleep.
Sort of like a vicious cycle. The less sleep you have, you know, the more irritable you are, so that can make you easily angered?
Oh, yeah. But again, it's not the less. They're still getting the same amount of sleep, but it stinks. It's micro-arousals. And there is a thought that during an arousal in your brainstem, there are certain neurochemicals that are slightly depleted, like your ever-ready battery. And all night, even though you get 8 to 10 hours, you deplete that battery and you feel crummy during the day.
Okay, let's go to our phones. Roger is with us in Davenport. Hi, Roger. You got a sleep problem to share? Roger, are you there? I'm sorry, Roger. We can't hear you. We're going to have to move on. Let's go to Charles in Mason City. Hi, Charles.
Hey. Hi. I thought you'd get some trifold, doctor. Trifold, actually. I wanted to talk about seasonal affective disorder, and I realized that I'm in the process of building a lab, and I think the distance and the amount of lux is important in that. Am I correct?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, duration of exposure and the amount of exposure, the quality of the light you're being exposed to.
Okay. This is something I ran across in a little bit of research, was that I noticed that there was a connection between antipsychotic drugs prescribed and sleep apnea machines.
Hmm. Okay.
You ever see that research in that order?
Well, I know my colleague, Dr. M, has done research on the association of antipsychotics, because he's board certified in psychiatry and internal medicine, and some of the medications that they use for depression and psychosis are often central nervous system stimulants that might actually have an effect on concomitant associated apnea. But apnea is almost like it happened 2 feet. One out of every 5 normal American adult has sleep apnea. So there is some research, and in fact, our Dr. M has done some of that, but you have to really look at that very carefully because it's such a common problem.
Okay. Thank you, Charles in Mason City. Here's an email from Alyssa in Anamosa. Dr. Daikin, I'm on a prescription that gives me extremely vivid dreams that I can usually recall in great detail upon awaking, writes Alyssa. How do vivid dreams affect quality of sleep? Is being able to remember dreams significant or indicative of a change in sleep quality? And she writes, when I have my more vivid dreams, sometimes I don't feel very rested the next day.
Hmm. Yeah, so it depends. You know, as we talked about, dream analysis is fascinating. Great rock and roll songs, blue suede shoes, satisfaction, the benzene ring were all thought up out of dreams. And also we know that in sleep apnea, we have a thing called the activation synthesis hypothesis. And when I was first diagnosed, my apneas are worse in REM, dreaming sleep, because there is less muscle tone. And what happens, Hobson and McCarley, two good friends from Harvard, said that you will then take that physiologic state of no oxygen and you will activate a dream and synthesize one that you're drowning. Now, my dreams were of drowning, and I've got to tell you, those were not pleasant dreams. And as such, it's the broad spectrum. You can have wonderful dreams where you relive blue suede shoes being created. I knew Carl Perkins. I mean, pretty cool. But when you dream you're drowning, the other end of the, or post-traumatic stress disorder. So vivid dreams, some people want it, and you could be trained to be a lucid dreamer to control your dreams. And then post-traumatic stress disorder, they can be either or.
All right, let's go to Stephen Stephen is in Des Moines. No, he's not. We're going to drop that call. Stephen doesn't seem to be there anymore. Let's go to Cassidy in Dubuque. Cassidy, are you there? Evidently not either. Let's go to a Facebook question. I know that'll be there because I see it on my screen. How accurate, writes Paula on our Facebook page, are Fitbit monitors for recording sleep?
Well, you know, Fitbit monitors parallel what we call actigraphy. And the great Peter Hari, one of my mentors from Mayo Clinic, he has passed, but he was the greatest at the time, insomnia doctor. And he says, once you've ruled out sleep apnea and sleep-related problems, and you're trying to follow a person's general sleeping state over many week or month period of time for insomnia, the Fitbit and the actigraphy, that movement that usually decreases when you go to sleep and increases when you're wide awake, isn't bad for following your general sleep pattern.
All right. An email from Stephanie in Cedar Rapids. My wife is a teacher and maybe gets 4 to 5 hours of sleep a night. Oddly, she seems to function better on this apparent lack of sleep than she does during the summer when she sleeps closer to 8 or more hours a night. She's tired, but overall performance seems to improve when she's worn out. Interesting. She winds up her email by saying, is there another way she can get some sort of relief from her exhaustion? When she tries to take naps during the day, she just winds up sleeping for about 3 hours and is still tired.
Well, you know, God bless her. And it often parallels what my wife did. So my wife, she went to Purdue and she was very much the academic. And she thought she could get by on 4 or 5 hours, but she was a good student. And during the school year, as is with your wife, I hypothesize she is interested, she's effective, she's dedicated, and that part of her personality keeps her going despite the fact that she may be sleepy. In the summer, she doesn't have that excitement, that quality of life, and paradoxically, it looks like she's not doing as well. What I would try to do is make sure she's stimulated academically all the time, but again, to try to work on that sleep at night. But if she's taking naps during the day, I try to limit it to about a 30, 45-minute period, because you can have the nap after a 30 to 45-minute period where you feel worse and you went to sleep, and we call that sleep inertia. But I would work at that. Keep her interested all year round. If she's going to take a nap, try to limit it to 30 to 45 minutes. Let her keep a diary to see how she feels after those.
Okay, let's go back to some more emails and phone calls in just a moment. Back to research, though. First of all, a new study that has uncovered a link between poor sleep and breast cancer risk. Dr. Daikin, you've looked at this study described in the International Journal of Cancer. What do you see there?
Well, actually, they added a little more to it. They said that in these women, they looked at tens of thousands, 50,884 women prior to being diagnosed with breast cancer. They followed them up over a seven-year period, and 2,000, 3,000 had developed breast cancer. And they found that there was association with women who had poor quality sleep and tended to sleep with artificial light on. They would sleep with the light on at night. And the thought was that combination of subjective poor sleep with the lights being on night did two things. We know that light, even through the closed eyelid, will depress the melatonin that's supposed to increase in the dark at night that make you normally sleepy. So it reduces that melatonin. And then poor quality sleep, disruption of your sleep at night, like with insomnia, can also reduce that melatonin. And it was hypothesized that that low melatonin can increase circulating estrogen and the risk of estrogen receptor positive breast carcinoma. So early research, but sort of an interesting finding, meaning poor sleep may not be good for you.
Okay, this is an email from Andy. I know we've talked briefly in previous shows about Andy. Andy mentions here, he says he's wondering if you could briefly discuss the research coming out around teens, specifically high school students, being chronically sleep deprived and how that relates to both school start times and the proliferation of smartphones. Also related to the latter, he asks whether or not Redshift apps for devices with screens are helpful or not. Do you know these Redshift apps? They sort of regulate the light coming into your eyes from your smartphone so that you don't get the, I guess, the blues and the whites as much?
Yeah, because the blue, and in fact, that's where we try to fool the system. If you use 5,000 to 10,000 lux, which is a level of illuminance in a blue spectrum, that is often mimicking the sun's effect to a lesser degree, so that that melatonin that increases, supposed to increase at night, is reduced and you're not as sleepy as when you should be, a circadian disruption, if you will. So if you're using the wrong app, you're also excited because you want to be using this app. You're still on the texting and you're having a light that may actually reduce Mother Nature's elevation of melatonin. So you do a double whammy on yourself with something like that. And by the way, young adults are sleep delayed. They're a phase delay. They tend to stay up later anyway. They need to sleep in longer. And here in Iowa City, my wife helped adjust the starting time for junior high and high school so that the kids are afforded a little bit longer sleep at night and they get to start school a little bit later. So a triple whammy, if you will.
Is there data on that? Are they following whether students are doing better with later start times?
And they do. Less truancy, more efficiency, going to school, better performance. The data is there, but look at it. You and I start work earlier. It's better when we drop our kids off earlier, so it's a psychosocial, and it is no good for football teams in Iowa. It's no good for cross country. I remember my
son. You start later, you have to go later, and then it cuts into football practice or whatever other sport.
Cross country, it would kill us, but in life, interesting.
Okay, let's go back to our, yes, it is. And a third of our lives, approximately, we spend sleeping. That's what we've been investigating this hour with Dr. Eric Dyken, neurologist and director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, having a few problems with our phone system. Let's try it again, see if our phone system is asleep or awake. Jaden, are you there in Cedar Rapids?
Yes, I am.
Jaden, excellent. What's your question or your experience?
Well, I'm 30 years old, and it seems like for about the last year or so, I've been waking up four or five, sometimes more times a night to use the restroom. I've tried cutting back on fluids and stuff, and I was just wondering if there was anything you guys could offer to try and help that.
That's a common problem. I think a lot of people will be interested in Dr. Dyken's answer here.
Well, and again, I'm biased, and you got to be careful when you listen to somebody on the radio. So my research is on obstructive sleep apnea, and you can have arousal to use the bathroom four or five times a night because you drink lots of water before you go to sleep, because you got diabetes, because you have a prostate problem, probably not at age 30, because you got a urinary tract infection, a million different things, or you're on a diuretic for another health-related issue. But in obstructive sleep apnea, where your airway closes off, when you try to breathe with untreated apnea, it stretches your chest. In your chest is your heart. At the top of your heart is the atrium. The atrium of your heart gets stretched, and the heart thinks it's in failure, so it protects itself by releasing a thing called atrial natriuretic factor, a diuretic to pee off that extra failure fluid that it's been tricked into thinking is there. So undertreated apneics or untreated will often wake up time after time because of this physiologic effect of an apnea to pee all night. So if this is really bothering you, which it appears it is, sit down with your healthcare profession, your local primary care physician, registered nurse, PAMA, talk about the full history, look at all these different things that could be causing it, and get the appropriate treatment that's focused on what's really causing it, and not just my bias for apnea.
Okay, Jaden, I hope we added to your knowledge about tackling your problem there.
Well, yeah, I've done two sleep studies that came back inconclusive, but I appreciate you guys' help.
Yeah, and you know, an inconclusive is always interesting because you can have apnea and still not have a positive study. So work on that.
Okay, we've got just a few minutes left. Let's go to this quick question. We haven't talked about sleepwalking. Ryan, in an email, asks, are there any recommendations for heavy sleepwalking? I sleepwalk and sleep talk to my wife's multiple times a week. Is it recommended to get researched or look into? Is there anything I can do to improve my sleep?
Well, sleepwalking, and as you know, we had one of the famous sleepwalkers who actually sleepwalked in front of a truck. His mom's been on, you know, all sorts of advocacy groups with American Academy of Sleep Medicine. So sleepwalking can be very dangerous. And there are things that can parallel sleepwalking. Under treated apnea, you can get up and walk because of an apneic event. But you need to protect the bedroom environment. And you need to make sure you find what the etiology of that sleepwalking is so that you address the right diagnosis.
What do you mean by etiology?
Well, the cause. So if you have an obstructive apneic event and you stop breathing during REM sleep, you may get up on fumes out of that sleep state and start to walk. We call that pseudo-REM behavior disorder. We could go into that later. But you could hurt yourself acting out a dream that
Let's say you have apnea, you feel there's a python around your neck, and that makes sense because you're not breathing very well.
Right.
And so you get out of bed to try to release yourself from this jungle python.
And as our patient did once, fell, hit his head, had a subdural hemorrhage. So my thought is treat the primary. And there are some adults under stress or pressure who can sleepwalk, protect your bedroom environment, but see your primary care physician.
Aaron is with us from Humboldt. I see on my screen, Aaron, you have a sleepwalking tendency as well?
Yes, I do, and it doesn't happen as often as twice a week, but I sleep incredibly hard. I sleep like the dead, basically, and it's really hard to wake me up. Everyone has a hard time waking me up if they see me out of bed and I'm sleeping. We've even tried putting locks on the door to where it's a complicated lock, to where you would have to be awake to open it. But somehow I've still got that into my head. Oh, I know how to unlock it. So in my sleep, I will unlock the complicated lock and still act out whatever it is that I think I'm dreaming. I've had a doctor that suggested I try and keep a sleep journal or a diary journal. But if I dream, I don't have any recollection of anything going on.
And also undoing this lock the next morning, unless if you weren't woken during your sleepwalk and your sleep lock picking, you don't remember it.
No, I have no idea. I've woken up with a loaf of bread in my bed. I have gone out into the living room and my front door is wide open. My oven and my refrigerator are open. I wake up with bruises that shouldn't be there. I mean, just strange things.
Yeah, and you know, and that's often, and we have a disorder, and you talk about the loaf of bread, a sleep eating disorder. And most people with these type of parasomnias, if you actually have an EEG on them and you follow them, they actually have a waking EEG pattern, but it's not a conscious awakening. It's a psychosocial sleep related, almost psychiatric kind of a disorder that normal people can have. But it's the broad, you know, the bell-shaped curve. Some of us can do this. But to unlock a very complicated lock, it implies it's not just what we would call a slow-wave sleep problem. It's a sleep behavior that, again, I would see a sleep expert for that, because you would address that one a little bit different than you would put it on a CPAP machine. But I would see your primary care, and don't lock the door. Have an alarm so that if your door opens, a loved one knows that the alarm's going off. But if your house burns down and you can't get that lock open, that could be dangerous.
Okay, we've come to the end of this hour with Dr. Eric Dykin of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. He's a neurologist doctor, and he comes to our studio, thankfully, about four times a year. Thank you very much. A little surprise going out. You didn't know this was going to happen. Besides being a world-class neurologist and sleep specialist, Dr. Dykin, a lot of our listeners do not know that you're a musical talent that plays around the Midwest. We're going to surprise you with a little bit from a video online. You are a member of the band called The Outsiders.
Yeah.
This, what we're going to hear, is a little tune from, what, the 60s or 70s? Bend Me, Shape Me?
Yeah.
And does this mean to do this to you?
Oh, no. It's a great song, 1966. We did it before the American breed.
Okay.
They made it famous, though.
Dr. Eric Dyken, also a member of the Outsiders. We're going to listen to this.
And if you need a band, let us know.
This is, no kidding, Dr. Eric Dyken with the lead vocals in about what you're about to hear. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks so much. Dr. Dyken, thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
I'm going to ask you on tape to send us out with a little music. Bend me, shape me, just let me sleep. How about that as a lyric?
Okay.
Thanks, Dr. Dyken.
Thank you.